Hi everybody, it's Derek Arden again, and welcome to the chat show. Tonight I am talking with Kevin O'Connor from Chicago, Illinois. Kevin has been a regular on this program. We've had some very interesting chats, and I actually first met Kevin in America when I was at a speakers conference, and in fact we were both following the same mentor, Nido Quibain, who made a massive difference to my life and actually helped me write my first book and put the testimonial in it. So he motivated me to do it. Motivation's a very important thing. We had a bit of fun last week. I challenged Kevin to give us some 1 minute tips. He wasn't allowed to run over the 1 minute. So I'd like a bit of clarification on one or two things to get my thinking straight. And the viewers have also asked me to do this. Kevin, the first one is, you said a psychiatrist friend of yours said if you could speak to five of your friends for 20 minutes, the psychiatrist would know more about the person than by interviewing the person themselves. Is that right?
You can put this into practice yourself if you do it this way. The next time you're coaching anybody, do a 360 on them that includes 5 or 10 of their colleagues that they have given you names and permission to talk to. And then you simply ask these colleagues, what does this person do best? What's one thing you'd like them to do a little bit better? And then you take all that and you throw it into a blender so they can't tell who said what. And you say, here are the major conclusions that the people you work with have said about you. And you don't have to get somebody that hates them or anything like that. You're getting people that work with them. And what you're getting, then what you do is you read, you don't give it to them, you read to this person what everybody had said. And say, and I'm going to read it slowly because I want it to kind of sink in for you. And then you say, what do you think about that? Sometimes I'll give somebody direct feedback nicely, I mean, lovingly, but it's very direct. And they will say, oh, yeah. And I said, and I'm not the first person to tell you that, am I? And they said, no, you're not. So this way, you get to confirm some of your intuition about the person as well. And I find that very, very useful. So I think if a psychiatrist knows about us from interviewing people, we can know a lot about a person, and a person can know a lot about themselves if we just take their coworkers and get permission. Yeah. And you don't say, what do you hate about the person? You just say, what did you like? What do they do very well? And then the next thing is, what would you like them to do just a little bit better? You might even think about, John was just talking about ability, I think he said, and you might also add to that capability. So ability refers to what I can do. Capability is referring to what I can do for you. So sometimes our resumes are full of experiences, and then the resume reader has to say, well, yeah, I know they did that, but can they also do, I know he did a card trick once, but does he have anything else up his sleeve, right? And so that's not just an ability to do the card trick, it's a capability to do many. And so what we ought to emphasize when we are being interviewed for any work is they say, well, have you worked with budgets? I've worked with budgets, but here's what I've learned from working with budgets and committees. That's far more interesting than, yes, I've worked with budgets, or I've worked with government, or I've worked with committees. So I'd like to all of us to just play around with words a little bit. For example, John mentioned Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I'm going to be interviewing someone who worked with her, a physician who worked with her for 20 years next week. And David Kessler worked with her. He just wrote a Harvard Business Review article in March. And he got, now get this, he got permission from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's family to include a sixth stage in the five-stage process that she made popular, that John did so well. And the sixth stage is meaning. We have acceptance, but now what's the meaning that all of this experience has had for me? Wow. He recommended, he said, we are in a stage of collective grief. But he said the next stage is going to be anticipatory grief. So we're in a collective grief. We can feel kind of tough. It's not easy to get out of bed sometimes. The anticipatory grief might be worse. What's it going to be like when things open up? Will I go to a restaurant? What happens to my friend's coffee shop that's been closed for so long? And as John knows, and many of us know, anticipating pain is sometimes worse than the pain itself.
Fantastic.
A friend of mine was a priest, and he had pain in this vein for his entire life. He said it was just excruciating. And they came up with a new thing where they inject formaldehyde, apparently, into the vein or into the nerve. And the only damage is it slumps a little, but you can get rid of the pain. And he said, this is great. He's in the doctor's office. The doctor said, this is going to work. He said, now, in some cases, though, it doesn't work, and unexpectedly, the pain will come back. But I'm pretty sure you're going to be okay. He said, anticipating the possible pain was worse than the pain that he had. He said, I had to really understand myself to not. So I think anticipation is interesting. Now, from our standpoint, I'll stop here.
I'm going to keep going, Kevin, because I've got a lot of questions for you.
What would happen if we take a word like grief? What Kessler did was he took a word like grief, and then he said anticipatory grief. Now, that adds an entirely different meaning. Collective grief. Community grief. So, and then he said, what could be beyond acceptance? I wonder if it's meaning. I wonder if we can figure out what this means to me personally and to our society. And then he did something I thought very interesting. He went to Kubler-Ross's family and said, is it okay if I add a sixth stage to this? So he got permission from the family, not from the publisher, not from the law, but from the family. Very interesting. It's on the Harvard Business Review in March of 2020.
There are several.
Thank you, John, for reminding me of that. Yeah.
As far as the model goes, there have been variations over the years. Some people say there are seven, some people, but she was the original.
Correct. She was. Yeah. I asked the fellow who studied with her, I said, was she the real deal? He said, she was totally the real deal. He said, she was like that 24/7.
That's an interesting question as well. Are we the real deal? Are we like that 24/7? Kevin, linking to this, and I quote, the physical opposite of anxiety and fear isn't peace, it's courage and determination. I love that. Yeah. But you then said, we all have to do this, and I have to do this coming out of my ears everywhere, which is great. And you said, and stop doing lists. A lot of people don't have stop doing lists. I'm not very good at stop doing lists. But what we need is a to-be list.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
Who am I gonna be in this argument that I'm having with my spouse? What do I want her to remember from this encounter? Do I want her to remember that I was right? Or do I want her to remember that I listened to her? Do I want her to feel like, I got that off my chest? Or do I want her to think, well, I guess he got that off his chest? And I think if we remind ourselves, what do I want this person to remember? If I get stopped by a policeman for speeding, what do I want them to remember at the end of the speeding ticket? That I was polite and that I understood that I did wrong, or that I'm going to be an arguer and I'm going to give him trouble and I'm going to make his day much, much worse. I got a speeding ticket last year for the first time in 20 years. I wasn't happy. I went to school to learn how to be a better driver. It was actually quite good. And so I wrote the trooper a letter thanking him for reminding me how dangerous it is to drive as I have been driving. I know he got it. He didn't respond. Maybe they're trained not to, but I felt better completing the cycle and understanding who do I now want to be? I'm the guy that people are passing by constantly as we're driving, because I am going the speed limit more or less.
That's a very short-term goal, isn't it? I like that. I was thinking it might even be a longer-term goal, you know, like what do I want people to say about me at my wake, or what do I want people to say about me in 10 years time or 5 years time? You know, is it Kevin O'Connor that made a difference? Or that's where I was coming from, and it's simple, isn't it?
Well, I'd rather be in process now, because when I'm dead, it's not going to make any difference, I don't think. At least that's my understanding. But I think instead of thinking about And I do think about, you know, what's my legacy or what's going to happen? Is this helpful? But I think if I think in terms of outcomes in the here and now, today.
Yeah.
For example, John brought up being grateful. What a great idea. And then feel the gratefulness. I write down every day three people I'm grateful for. Derek, you've come up a few times in on my list over the last 500 days. And but it's very interesting when you look at those names over time and you think, yeah, that's right. I am grateful for that person. And I just connected with a fellow that I met in 1971. I worked for him for 3 months. He completely changed my life. I'm a speaker because of him. I'm a teacher because of him. And I haven't talked to him since that time. And so I called him yesterday. We had the most lovely chat. And I thought to myself, I'm experiencing his to-be list, and he's experiencing my to-be list. It was really a lovely meeting of the spirits. I hope we will talk again. I don't know why I haven't talked to him for 40 years.
That's brilliant. But,
life's brilliant. In different directions.
Right, third question. I'm going to keep going on this because there's a lot of value in this, and it's very good. Now, this is something I don't believe because I met you in 2010. I always enjoyed your company. We connected. You have a great sense of humor. It's a bit dry and it's great fun and it's really good. But you said last week that you come from Irish roots and your second language is sarcasm. And that's then you said it comes from the Greek sarcosmo, which means to tear flesh. I've never experienced you being sarcastic.
Everybody else in the world does, apparently. My students do. I think maybe because you speak that British form of language. I don't know. But I used to get in trouble for it all the time. Now, in our family, we think it's funny. And so people who are sarcastic with each other, we think that's funny. When people are more sensitive or they don't engage in that themselves, it can be hurtful. Because as you said, it means tear the flesh like dogs. So there's a little bit of fun, but a little bit of meaning. Is it Shakespeare that said, when we jest, we tell the truth? Oh. And so I wonder if that's sarcasm is a little way to kind of give a little dig, as we say here. Sometimes the other person walks away with, I wonder what that meant. What was that all about? So it's an indirect way of maybe being judgmental. It's an indirect way of being. And then all you have to do is say, well, I was only kidding. So if they challenge you on it, say, well, what do you mean by that? I was only kidding. And then, so it's a passive aggressive way of confronting someone. And in a sense, it feels like you got it off your chest. The problem is what I've discovered, I gave it up for Lent, as I told you. So that's a long time to not do it. Then what happens is you really start to understand the damage that it can do, not only to another person, but the damage it can do to you. So I'm working very diligently at it. I think about being, it's part of my to-be list.
Okay, thanks for that. Well, I always claim that I come from Shakespeare because Shakespeare's mother was Mary Arden. So clearly I do. I can't get that back that far in ancestry, thank goodness. I might as well claim it, mightn't I? And One of the questions Ryan Pereira asked me yesterday was, how do English people blow their own trumpet? And I was, he's worried in his company if he brags a bit, he'll get shot down. And English people are pretty careful about that. And I said, that's a massive subject, but if you don't blow your own trumpet, no one else will. But it's how you do it in the UK, which is different across in the US.
Well, think about John today when he did his trick. Think about how you're coming across right now. You come across with confidence, but you don't come across in a braggadocio kind of way. When I asked John about his trick last week and I told a friend of mine, he said, oh, he will know exactly what I did. He'll know exactly how I did. It's just a standard trick. We all know. And so that's it's still confidence, but he's not offended that someone else will know how he did the trick. He's doing the magician thing, which is they share with one another. They're admiring of one another. Look how he did that trick, that I know how he did it, but look how he, wasn't that beautiful? It's kind of like, do you ever remember when we used to go to restaurants?
No, I can't remember that far back.
What's a restaurant? What's a restaurant?
And people would say, oh, look at the presentation, right? And in America, I don't know if they do it there, people take pictures of their food before they eat it at restaurants. And then they email it to their friends. And, you know, one of my friends takes a picture of his plate when he finishes it. He said, look how good this was.
Wow.
And there's all these just little tiny scraps of food on the plate. But I think when we can be confident, I am confident within myself, as opposed to I have to prove to you that I'm better in some way. Well, then you get this, and nobody likes to be talked down to. And in fact, this is a very dangerous position, superiority position, because if I get fed up with you, all I have to do is leave, and it's a long way, fast way down.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a very dangerous way to have a marriage. It's a dangerous way to raise children, dangerous way to be in our... But when we do this, then I can understand Derek's competence and his capabilities. I understand John's. I understand the value Duncan adds to this. By the way, is Duncan Scottish?
Very.
Very, okay. I was very picking Scottish. Up that accent. Okay. And then I can understand mine, and we can collaborate on a horizontal plane instead of on a vertical plane, which is how sometimes we've been taught in the past. So I think when we do that, we have an opportunity to really understand each other's capabilities, and then Brilliant. We can encourage them.
Brilliant.
What it is, yeah. Kevin, is that we're all good at something. We're not all good at everything.
That's right.
We all need each other to fill in the gaps. So yep.
I can't remember if I heard it on the chat show. Tell me if somebody said this a few weeks ago.
If it's good, I said it.
Right. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant.
Isn't that great? And
brilliant.
Dreikers and Adler, famous psychiatrist that I studied, said, whenever you feel depressed, the best way to solve a depression is to go and do something nice for someone else. Because depression is inside. I'm going in. Think about yourself in the morning in bed. I don't want to get out of bed. It's raining terrible. You're going inside. But if I go outside and do something for someone else, I can't do both at the same time. What gets me out and gets me of service is doing for someone else. So I think that's what John was referring to when he talked about his mastermind group. Now, here's interesting. Now, you know, I'm a pretty brilliant guy sometimes, you know, and I'm pretty confident.
We know that, Kevin. We know.
I'm okay. I'm good, you know. Yeah.
Humble.
I have a mastermind group that has not. I have a mastermind group that has not met in a year, or we haven't met for, I guess, 4 months, because we can't travel. Duh, right? Now we have Zoom. Why didn't one of us say, why don't we just get on Zoom every week? I mean, this is ridiculous, right? I mean, the first thing I'm going to do when I get off of this is to write my friends. Now, what I need to say is I'd like to invite you to a meeting on Zoom. I'm not going to say, hello, are we all dumb? You know, I'm not going to go into sarcasm. I'm just going to invite them and say, what do you think about us getting together? And
great idea, Kevin. Kevin, I want to mention three things. So another question for you that John and those of us who... self-employed would be very interested, and I can't get my head around that. But two things before I mention that. Number one is when I left Barclays, and I was a pretty good negotiator, I'd been studying it. I went to Harvard for a week and I studied under Bill Urey, and I paid $1,000 a day, and that was 20 years ago. Yeah. And he got somebody up on stage and he did this exercise. So he said, got the other person up and he said, push against my hands and you know, put the pressure on and get balanced. And then he said, and I'm going to step away now. And what happens? So we got win-win here. But, you know, if we keep, if you keep pushing against me, I'm going to push back. And then he stood away. And of course, the person falls flat on their face. And that reminded me what you said there about you can be up here, you be down here. And the other expression is, there's two expressions that I wanted to just mention. A friend of mine told me this the other week, and I thought about some of my friends. Sometimes on the way up, and I like to think we're all on the way up, because this is my mastermind group. It meets every three times a week at the moment, and it's fantastic. Sometimes on the way up, we got to stop and let some people off. Yeah. You know, I've got friends that I used to get a lot of energy from, but as Gabby said yesterday, you know, stick around radiators, don't stick around drains, and do the people drain your energy.
Right.
The three of those people are a lot of time for very energy draining now. And I feel guilty about that. I will still.
It reminds me of the net and networking. And that also lets people fall through. So it catches the good stuff, right? Yeah. And then others go through, and it's a natural process, and they may come back at some point. But you know, Dreiker's used to say, famous psychiatrist said, you can never require cooperation, you can only win cooperation. So that's why the fighting exercise is so futile. You're putting all that energy into fighting or resisting or any of that sort of stuff, when in fact the other person just has to do this. Bully husbands are very weak when the wife decides to leave. They need the wife, they need a subservient wife there to beat up on, or there's nobody to beat up on. And as soon as she says, I'm out, and she finds a safe place, he's at his weakest, most impotent self. And he either has to find another target, or he has to start doing terrible things to her, which the law then allows us to put restraining orders and that sort of stuff. And we have bully bosses too. We have them here for sure.
Oh, we have them in the UK as well. There's a lot of them. Absolutely. There's some. Oh yeah, John knows about this. But when I took over as president of the Speaking Association, the board was pretty complicated people, and there were people that went to the board meetings just to disagree with the president. And Graham Jones is my biggest supporter, as you know, and we had to get together and deal with them, because I think they just thought this is just going to be a bit of a laugh and push against whatever Derek and Graham come up with. And the only way I could deal with it was to pick them off one by one, which was hugely time consuming and cut me off. But I was doing it, as Covey says, start with the end in mind. And the goal was to leave the organization in better shape than I took it over. And John does know this. It was hugely stressful as well. I used to wake up 3 o'clock in the morning about it, until I suddenly thought, I have to use every negotiation tactic in my book that I've written about on an organization where I'm giving my time for nothing. But there we go. Face these things where you don't expect to face them. Kevin, the question number five is, I want to really get my head around this. Consider letting your clients set your fee and pay them what you think they're worth. I'm not sure I'm brave enough to do that, or even to say it, but I'm
not sure about that one either. I'm doing it with students this summer. I'm giving them a 12-week summer seminar. I didn't know what to charge, because it's off the books from the university. It's somewhat sponsored. It's not a course. They said, how much do you want to get? I said, why don't you pay me what you think it is worth to your practice at the end of 12 weeks? This is making them all insane. They're asking me, they're asking my teaching assistant, what does he really want? How much? How much is too much? How much is not enough? One of my clients today said she's doing a book study club. She said the fee is an optional $25 if you feel like you're able to pay it and you find that it's worthwhile. Each session. So then we would, and that then leaves it up to the person. She's calling it optional. Another alternative is to have three fees when you're making a proposal. I don't know if we talked about this yet, but one is one that is basic. Then there's the third one, which is fantastic. That's the Bentley. But then in the middle is maybe a nice Porsche. And that's the one you want them to choose. You don't want them to pick the Bentley, because that's like out of bounds. But the Porsche is so exciting, because you're throwing things in. You'll get to get John's newsletter every month. Whoa, really? In addition to having him live? Absolutely. Now, that costs John nothing, right? He'll do a trick at the end of every, really? Would he do that for our meeting? Yes. So, you know, in the United States, we're, for meetings, they are hiring a group that will bring a llama to your business meeting at a local preserve. And so at the end of the meeting, they said, let's go on a tour of the blah, blah National Wildlife Preserve. Here's Bob. He's our llama. And the llama comes up everybody's laughing and joking, of course. And he said, let me show you where he lives. And they take you around the zoo and show you. It's $200. So that's, I don't know how many quid that is, but there's $200. And so it's kind of a fun way to end the meeting. You've had this business meeting, and then you have this. Or you have a business meeting, and you have someone like John come in and do some magic tricks virtually. I wonder if that's something we maybe ought to think about doing on a regular basis for our business meetings. Why do they have to end with, okay, any more questions? Why can't they end with, and we have a guest to come in to talk about, just for example, what John talked about today or what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's really food for thought. In fact, I did Royal Bank of Scotland, I did a session in the National Railway Museum in York. In fact, John popped along for a little while and helped me out. And I decided I had to get some pictures. So actually, we went down and I did a session in the museum against one of the most famous steam trains. I think it was the Flying Scotsman. And we got some pictures. Now, all the people wandering around didn't know what was going on. And we had to do it in the tea break because I know all the people would have left because I kind of sent there. And there was 40 people on the course. But it was memorable. And what I was thinking about you is they won't, if you do something like that, they'll never forget it, will they? And they'll never
Won't. Absolutely. And that'll be the highlight. It'll be the highlight of me. My son told me that, you know, we all have these virtual backgrounds. I'm using one today. He said, instead of going out, get a virtual background in your home. So take pictures of your home, your backyard, your favorite tree. And he said, then that becomes the warm atmosphere that you're trying to project. So this is a bookcase that I'm looking at now that's over here. It's the first time I've used it. So Derek, you and I talked about it yesterday. So take pictures of around the house.
There's just one problem with a virtual background, isn't there? And both you and John have had it a little bit in that, so you leave your head behind when you move around.
If you get a green screen, that should, I'm going to get
I did try it, but I wasn't sure how well it worked, really. I think I told you, Kevin, that Graham sent me this with 5 minutes notice before we did our top masterclass on Tuesday, which was really kind of him. And I did put it in, but you know, you can see if I move around. And I've got a green screen. I tried it against the green screen and it didn't look any more different to me. And the other problem was I had to put the green screen right behind me, so it felt a bit claustrophobic. And I'm not too,
you don't want that to happen for you.
Oh, I'm not too keen on that. So that doesn't suit me.
Now, John, is that a green screen you've got?
Yeah. This is, there you go. That's it. That's without any background.
Now, is that on a stand or on a...
That is a pop-up. It folds into three. I'll send you the link. I'll put the link in the chat box.
Right.
And you can see it. So it's 1.5 meters tall. Sorry, 2 meters tall, 1.5 meters wide.
How close is it to you?
It is about maybe 30 centimeters behind me.
How much is a centimeter?
Okay, it's about 12 inches.
So like half of your arm?
Yeah. It's up to the elbow. It's put your fingers up to the elbow.
Pretty close then, yeah.
You want this in qubits? we got the measurements in qubits.
Remember, I'm a foreigner, okay?
you're a very welcome Irishman into our team.
One last thing, in case we're stopping soon. it's more about this business of ability and capability and the added thing that he talked about, anticipatory grief. Adding an adjective in front of common words makes people wonder about it. Huh, never heard of anticipatory. I know grief, but what is that? Community or communal grief. So one person said yesterday, I was on a call and he's talking about fundraising. It's a nonprofit. And he said, this is a time when you can ask for money. He said, don't be shy, just be sensitive.
Like that.
Okay. So we parse our words a little bit. It gives, you can't quite put it in a box in your head as easily as you used to. So if I think of negotiation as conversation to a mutually felt positive goal, that works a little better with my personality than negotiation as tactics. If I said negotiation as a collection of capabilities and skills, in the same way that you have skills in a conversation, now I'm much more likely to enter into understanding what, you know, Derek has kind of mentioned about his way of teaching and helping people get to a win-win. Or if you thought, because we've heard of win-win, I think it's on the bookcase behind you in a double prominent way, which is kind of...
Well, that's just a coincidence. I don't know how it got there.
I think
there,
your wife may have put that up. I'm looking for
probably.
But what if we thought about a win-win-win?
Yeah.
So people have heard of win-win, but what's the third win? Maybe the third win is for the community or our piece of the world. Maybe it's what Kessler's talking about with meaning, or the other people that have come up with other ways of expanding Kubler-Ross. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal. I remember, John, remember it was a big deal when Kubler-Ross came out and people said, you mean I don't have to go through each step in a linear way. You can go back and forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people got confused. Well, I've already been angry. Why am I getting angry again now 6 months later? And we started to understand that when someone dies, one of your friends dies, the 6 month anniversary is a major deal for the survivors, as is the 12 and 18 month anniversary. But everybody figured the 1 month anniversary is tough. Why are they still having a problem at 6 months? You got to snap out of it, right? And instead, what we need to do is remind ourselves they're still going through all the stages, but they're going through them in a non-linear way. And then that helps us understand. Adler said, see with their eyes, hear with their ears, feel with their heart, and then you can really come to a better understanding of people.
Kevin, that's great. I'm going to close the recording in a second.
By the way, I've just put in the chat box. I'm sorry for interrupting. I've put in the chat box the link to the green screen that I have.
Ah, great. If you want to copy that,
and then paste it into your browser. It's not available at the moment, but you'll see the kind of thing that I'm using.
Okay.
And you'll need a pole to put it to hang it on.
Let's stay on the line after I close the recording down. Kevin and I attended High Point University in North Carolina with this genius, Nido Cobain, who I'm always talking about, and no one knows who he is over here. I'm the only Brit that's ever attended it. And he made his own words up, and one of the words was intentional congruence. I assume he made that up, Kevin.
Yes. Which
kind of meant that you... if you did one thing, you then turned it into 20 products, or you turned it into something else. Or if you chaired one meeting, you did other things at the same time. And he was a genius with words, as is Patricia Fripp, a genius with words as well. And I'm listening to one of her podcasts today as I've been nagging her to get her on here and talk about her words. But the language is just so important. And I don't know if it's, it may be Americans are better at using the English language in a positive way or using more visual expressive language. I don't know, Kevin. Certainly the people I'm following are all from your part of the world.
We might be more manipulative with our vocabulary in a sense that there's a lot of selling that goes on in our business, as you know, and we're trying to avoid, we want to be distinctive. So I wonder if that's an advantage, is that if you think to yourself, add a word, and that, then I become distinctive. And it's hard to put it in a box in your head. If I say you're a negotiator, everybody knows what that means, and they stick it in a box in their head, and it's probably either positive or negative based on who else is in that box with you. But if we say you're a conversational negotiator, what the hell is that? Or if we say you're an adaptive negotiator.
I'm writing all this down, Kevin. It will be on my website tomorrow morning.
But I don't know if you're on the NSA Influence twice a week workshops they're doing. NSA, National Speaker Association, has a convention in August. Looks like it's going to get canceled. They're not sure. So what they did is they're releasing all of the breakouts twice a week in a Zoom fashion. So we're getting all the breakouts. We paid for it. And then if you want to come to the convention, you'll get all the keynotes in case we have a convention. Mm-hmm. So they had a woman on yesterday, Michelle Villalobos, who runs three-day retreats. Now she's doing them on Zoom. But one of my clients today, when I was on the line with her, she said one of my clients asked me if I would do a book club. Now she's a counselor, a therapist. And she said, what do you think about that? I said, I think it's a great idea. I said, nothing better than when your audience asks you. And she said, what should I do? And I said, I took Villalobos' idea, sell it first, figure it out later. So she's starting with a book club, but I said, do a reverse pyramid. So the book club is at the bottom. What if the next step is not another book club? What if the next step might be her leadership circle of former book club people who then wind up doing something that Derek and I did at High Point University? And then gradually she's expanding her offerings. She might even talk about a retreat that she's planning in a few months. She doesn't have to have the retreat planned. She just has to talk about it. And then people say, do you think I could come to that? I think, yeah, that would be great. Would you like to come to that? She said, how am I going to get more people in my book club? I said, you make the one person who came to you and said, I'd like to do a book club. I said, you make her your teaching assistant, your book club assistant. She'll sell it for you to all of her book club buddies, because that's a whole underground. I don't know if they do that in the UK, but we have book clubs all over the place and they're ravenous. So this is the one where she's charging $25 optionally, but it's suggested. Well, they're probably going to pay her, you know, because they're going to enjoy it. And then we talked about what the outcomes would be and some format ideas she could use, just like you experiment with formats, Derek. And you bring in substance, you bring in entertainment, you bring in kind of fun, you tell Jill what to do, you know, stuff like that. So then she can start thinking in a more expansive way about, it's not just a book club, it's an opportunity to engage with people. Villalobos said, information is not transformation. So she said, when you're on a Zoom call, give people time to think. Put them in a chat box, but also say to them, I want you to turn your screen off and for 15 minutes, I want you to write about, and then we're going to come back together. We did that on an NSA Illinois website the other day. She had us stop and write for about 5 minutes. And nobody's ever done that before on one of my Zoom calls. I thought that was really smart. Another one said, let's take a 2-minute break. Another one, after a half hour, he said, we're taking a 5-minute break. I have to go to the bathroom. Why don't you do that too? Everybody got up. Then you come back, you're refreshed. So it's very interesting to kind of see what will happen.
Kevin, we did that on Tuesday. You came in at 4 o'clock in the morning to Graham Jones and my masterclass. Did that work? We had three breaks, didn't we?
That was it. That was it.
Yeah.
4 o'clock in the morning. That was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, we liked your pajamas. Your pajamas are pretty nifty, actually. They were pretty good.
It was very good. You were both quite brilliant. Yeah. Oh, here's another thing. Can I give you one more?
Yeah. I don't want to miss any of this, so let's keep the recording going.
Last one. So, two things. One of my writing coaches says, write drunk, edit sober.
Yeah.
Just write, for God's sakes, just write. The other one says, write in your natural chunk style. If you normally can write for 30 minutes, that's your goal. If you can normally only write for 10 minutes, that's your goal. You're not supposed to write for 4 hours at a time like the pros do. And then the last one is, I've noticed, tell me if this is your experience, whenever somebody's giving a presentation, it takes them about 8 or 9 minutes to get to the good stuff. And I find that very frustrating. They talk about themselves, or they talk about what the weather's like, or they talk about kind of BS, right? And then all of a sudden, they start giving you the good stuff. And you know, all right, we just hit their magic expertise, their inner expert. That's when the audience says, I'm in. And I would recommend that we do that eighth minute during the first minute. Give them the good stuff. We talked about dessert first here in the past. Give them really good stuff immediately. Don't say thank you, it's great to be here, you're looking great today. Immediately you start with content. Now, then 5 minutes later you can say, my name is, I do blah blah, we're here today for. But you grab them with what's really good. And in fact, that's what entertainers do. They immediately get us interested in what they do. They don't say, I'm gonna talk about, and then I'm gonna tell you a story, and then I'm gonna sing a song. Bang, they just start right away.
I want to ask you something on that. And so should I say, so good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, my nine negotiating mistakes that speakers make are: number one, they don't prepare. Number two, they don't watch the body language. Number three, good afternoon, my name's Derek Arden. No.
That would be lame.
Sorry?
Yeah, that would be lame.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say you should instead say, you know, I was thinking the other day, if I could do one thing over in my life as a negotiator, it would be blah, blah. I was in Surrey in 1963. That's a suburb, right? It's a town?
Yeah.
I was in Surrey in 1963. I came across a man. He had a rugged face. I knew he'd been around life. Now, all of a sudden, you got it. They know exactly what he looks like. They're talking about your own experience. And you're saying, if there's one thing, you don't want 7 or 10, can't remember that many. We can only remember 3.
Okay.
That's why the 10 commandments don't work. We can't remember them, right? So finally, Jesus got it down to 2, love God and love your neighbor. I can do that, okay. But the 10 are hard to remember, the 7 of this. Now you might, your speech might have 7 or 8 or 9 techniques, that's okay. But always refer back to the initial story about the rugged-faced man in Surrey when you do it. And you know what he did? He leaned forward. And that's a body language thing that I want to point out to. That's another thing that I would like to do differently if I was starting all over again. He was quiet at one point. When's the last time you were quiet during a negotiation? And what did you notice about that? And then tell another story. So this way, what's happening is you're not dumping information on me like sometimes teachers did in the old days. You're engaging me in your journey, and I'm alive with examples. If you tell me the example of this man, I know exactly what he looks like. And you should help me know exactly what he looks like. And that's not... inconsequential. It's not frivolous. It's important to the story that I know what he looks like. So if any one of you had said, I came across, I learned this the other day, and then you can say what the person was like or what the experience was like, you're in a sense taking me into your visual field about what that is like, and if you do it well, we know exactly what you're talking about. And if we went to a sketch artist, of course they would all be different, but it makes it real for me. And when we do that, then you're conveying this business that John was talking about earlier of the feelings. You're not just talking about the data, but you're incorporating the feelings, and the feelings are the things that, you know, I've been writing down for however we've been locked up, who I'm grateful for, and I write down their name. The idea that I got from John today is bring back the feeling of why you put that person's name down, which then, he's right, you know, then I get to use my natural chemicals, but it makes it even, it's why I called this guy after 40 years the other day, you know, it occurred to me, wow, you know, I haven't talked to him. Now, in real life, I would be too busy. I'd be at the airport. I'd be preparing a presentation. Probably wouldn't even think of it. So this time of collective grief and collective reflection. I mean, I said to somebody the other day, I've noticed birds make noises and fish jump. Who knew that, right? So it is a period of, you know, we give it a word and then reflection. So you might add an adjective in for you. And the word reflection, responsiveness to our environment.
So I'm going to switch the recording off now, Kevin. Yeah. Thank you so much for those ideas. You're going to stay on the line for a minute? I've got an idea for you if you really want it. If John stays on as well, just for a minute. I'll just, so thank you, Kevin O'Connor from Chicago. Thank you, John Hatalka. And we look forward to you joining us again, please, on the Live Chat Show.